Ready? Okay. Okay. I call the meeting to order. Now read the roll call. Ms. Hasty?
Here.
Ms. Restrepo? Doug Quittle?
Here.
Jeff Boone?
Here.
Frank Crawford?
Here.
Gary Quittle?
Here.
All members are present. Ms. Hasty, will you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Since this is a study session, public comments will be heard after the presentation. So if we have any comments, it'll be a part of that discussion period after the presentation. I don't have any comment cards, but this is a study session, so you don't need the formal comment card. But any comments have to be on the subject matter that we are presenting today. So Jessica?
Mr. Davis, I'd like to introduce the Capital Advisors Group. They're going to start by showing us a presentation and talking to us about the budget and what's coming up next year.
Thank you all so much. To the board, it's a pleasure to be with you today. We don't have to have this be too dark. This is perfect. So I want to just start by, saying it's a pleasure, first of all, not only to be presenting some of the backdrop just right after the governor has produced his budget presentation to give you guys a context, but to also talk a little bit about our role, and then we're going to go into talking about some of the applications of the budget. I first want to make an important comment that is important about the leadership of both the board and the superintendent with regard to engaging us. There are a lot of district clients that we have where we're engaged to come in and consult with you guys individually about what the strategy of the district might be. There are some districts that are like yours, not a lot, who engage us to be part of a public conversation. And that as we talk to you guys and we share information, that the objective that you clearly have made clear to us is that you want us to be doing this for the benefit of the board and the community and our labor partners collectively, that is not an issue about you trying to own the source, but really trying to make sure that we're providing information that's shared across the community. And we just really applaud that because it gives everybody a chance to have the same kind of information. It's not necessarily that everybody's going to agree with our read on it, but I think we're going to probably do a pretty good job of pulling together kind of what our collective interest should be. And it actually, I think, reflects a lot of what we see with our counterparts that we work side by side with in Sacramento that are actually our labor partners up there, and including the PTA, where there are some major issues we have to work on that are uniquely going to actually be in the interest of this district, because there are specific kinds of things in a wonderful budget that we have to pay attention because they're going to have implications for Marysville. So with that, let me go into the first slide. So this is the one that talks a little bit about our role. As advocates for public school districts across the state, our objective is to do a few things. And again, we represent some of the big statewide associations and we've got a number of different clients, but when a district engages us, it's specifically for the reason of not just sharing with you the news you can get a lot of different places. I like to say there are a lot of people who can report the news, but what you really want to do is be working with folks that help make the news. That means the team of people that are actually in meetings, the legislature looks to for advice on how to write language, how to work on that budget trailer bill, how to do some things that will inject the issues that ultimately will affect this district. The other issue is that it's too infrequently that the legislature is actually listening to the unique circumstances of individual districts as it makes policy. When you guys engage, again, in the legislative you know, process the way you're doing it. It helps get the Marysville story in front of people. It's going to be our job to actually be talking about examples from this district as they start to try to set policy, and that's part of our objective here. And then the second point is really important. There are going to be big chunks of money allocated for different kinds of purposes. And to the degree that we can work with Jennifer and the superintendent and your team to make sure they're aware of what some of the rules are that are wrapped around this particular programs, there are districts constantly who completely miss the opportunity because they weren't paying attention to some of the financial opportunities there are with different pieces of money. And some of it will be stuff you're not interested in, but some of it will be, and we want you guys to make that choice. A classic example is in the career pathways area. There's a big chunk of money, almost $2 billion that's going to come down for career pathways. There's some districts that are just not necessarily interested in it. A lot of the money is going to be grant-based. Our job is to help your team go after that money if it's an area that's important to this board and go secure those dollars. And really, in the overall sense of the budget, it's our job to tell you where those financial opportunities are and also where the threats are, that they're trying to pass budgets in a way that actually don't help this district and maybe disproportionately don't help this district compared to other districts. So that's one of the things that we think is really important. And then, of course, some of these other things about monitoring all the different agencies in the legislature to protect your interests. And the example on that one is that, yes, we're lobbyists, we lobby the legislature, we work on state budgets. But every now and then you get a knock at the door from the state controller and they want to audit something. And we've been involved many times in this case where they want to go after a district for something that's completely not legit. And you guys deserve to have an argument made in rebuttal to what it is they're putting forward. And sometimes it can mean very significant resources. So whether it's the state controller or it's any other, you know, government agency, the California Department of Finance, where they're posing challenges to the district, the other is on waivers. You know, that the state board has broad waiver authority. This district in the past has gone to the state board to try to get waivers. You shouldn't have to do that on your own. That's a role that we can play a role in helping too with, and going to the state board and saying, look at, here's the case we want to make to get the state board to actually waive a section of law that'll be in the advantage of the district. So I want to see if you guys have any questions on that before I go into, we start this conversation about the budget. Any questions about the role that we would play for you?
Any questions from the board?
Great. The other thing I will add is that, you know, the superintendent has made it very clear to us that her expectation is that we're made available to you, this board, to come up on occasion during really critical parts during the budget process, the legislative process. If you guys have some need to have us come up here, that all you need to do is ask. And one of the advantages is we're close enough to Sacramento that we can get up here with pretty last minute notice to help apprise you of whatever the issue is that you may be concerned about. So let's turn now to kind of the fiscal outlook in California and what the budget looks like. And again, these are just key points that I put together that I think will help frame the whole conversation and put this budget in the context. As a sitting school board member, when you know, local media comes to you and says, hey, what do you think of this budget? And for those of you that have watched budgets, if you've watched them over the last few years, the idea of a budget in a single year that puts $16.1 billion of new spendable money on the table for public education, it's very hard to say that it's anything but fantastic until you sort of look at the detail. And what I like to point out is that how we get that money, what the nature or the characteristic of the money, one time versus ongoing, some of the different definitions of the uses of the money, all of that matters a lot. And the classic example is that mix of one time versus ongoing. Is that oftentimes our public, and we like to help by presenting here at the board, the public to understand that you can look at that so top line number, $16.1 billion, and it doesn't tell the whole story, because when you have almost half or a little bit more than half of the money is one time only, what do they tell us over and over again from the state level? Do not commit that money for ongoing purposes. So then you got to think about, well, what would be a one-time purpose we can use? And there's lots of ideas, but it's really important to note that it doesn't contribute to the long-term fiscal solvency of the district. The second major characteristic about this budget, over half of it is one time, is that an overwhelming amount of the money that's left over is restricted. So now, sort of the average person that might be watching this board meeting would say, well, what does that mean? I mean, you're getting the money. Restricted means that the legislature, the great school board under the dome in Sacramento, who thinks, you know, they can tell better than maybe local school districts how you might use the money, have decided already how you're going to get the money and how you're going to spend it. So they're sending you money for certain things, and they're not bad. The problem is that they're restricted just for that purpose. So a very real example that we're having happen, districts are getting sent money for a very specific purpose, but you have really serious sort of fiscal stability needs that you want to balance your budget, and you cannot use a dime of that money for that purpose. We had a board where I was doing a presentation with just a couple weeks ago where one of the board members sitting in the chair, just like you guys are, leaned over to the CBO who is presenting the plan on how to spend some of the restricted money that calls for the expenditure, and it's actually ongoing money, this one program, for some positions and some expenditures in the district. And the board member leaned over and said, don't we have an $18 million deficit on our budget? And she responded, yes, actually, that's true. We have a deficit. But we've been sent money for a specific purpose. We can carry out that purpose. We're going to spend the money for that purpose. And we still have the deficit. And that didn't contribute a dime to solve the deficit. So you can have two things happening at the same time. And it's just totally not comprehensible to the average person. You're running a big deficit and you're spending a bunch of money. How can that possibly be the case? And that's how, when the legislature does that. So our goals should be, even though they're well-intended purposes, to try to get the legislature and the governor as much as possible to give us the resources to get well in our budgets, to stabilize our budgets and do something for the base of the budget. And I'll talk about that in a little bit about why that matters, the base. So if you look at one-time money and you look at restricted money and you say, what's left? The only money that goes into the base of school funding, money that we use to keep the lights on, money that we use to pay our people who are deserving of that consideration. But when the only amount of money that's put into the budget is the 5.33% COLA, is the only money that goes into the base out of $16.1 billion, we know a few things about it. Is what does the COLA do for us? What does a cost of living adjustment do for us? What I like to point out is a cost of living adjustment makes sure that we don't fall backward. It is actually for the increased cost of things that have gone up, for the very thing, same things we're already doing. So if you give me an adjustment to pay for what I'm already doing that just keeps me even with inflation, you haven't given me a dime to move forward. This COLA, it's a 5.33% projected COLA in the budget, is anticipated to go up to above 6%. Slightly, it's going to be a huge COLA. But as Jack will probably point out, you were telling me this yesterday, the president has identified very publicly that even on a national basis, the U.S. Consumer Price Index is over 7%. I always put this assertion on the table to Sacramento. I've been getting louder about it in the last year or two, that the COLA, this COLA, it's predicated on a market basket of goods and services purchased by state and local government. That's kind of a mouthful. It's an index in Washington, D.C. by the U.S. Department of Commerce. And what they did, they wrote a law many years ago that says the COLA for K-12 will be whatever that number generates every year. The problem is the market baskets of goods and services purchased by states and local governments has nothing to do with our costs, nothing. And in fact, if you think about the things that these gentlemen are going to talk about, whether it's STIRS and PERS or special ed or all those cost drivers we have, it doesn't keep pace with the real things that are driving our costs up. So I actually think our index, if they would bother to create one just for K-12, which they should, would be a lot higher than the 5.33, than the 6%. So assume we end up getting a super COLA or something bigger than that. What does it do? It probably just keeps us even with inflation. So what do we need to do to advocate on your guys' behalf? We need to advocate for them to not just put money into the base, but put money into the base beyond inflation. That gives us the ability. And what we're telling legislators, because We know that they have a positive sentiment toward our classified and our certificated employees. We know they listen to teachers. They value our employees. But what we're trying to tell them is you don't value our employees if you're not putting money into the base beyond COLA. We have to have something beyond what it takes to keep the lights on, and that's going to be our challenge. In a $16.1 billion budget, seemingly overflowing, you're not paying attention to the base, and we need to do that. The last two issues, which we will go into a little more detail, Barrett's going to talk a little bit more about it, is the impact of declining enrollment, which this district is facing. The whole issue about ADA funding, which we know if you look over the last 3 years, sort of the last 36 months, inclusive of the year that's coming, that during that period of time, we got bad years as a metric to rely upon in terms of what's going on with enrollment. We need a solution to that problem too. If we don't get a combination of these issues addressed, the district's going to be in a situation and you won't be alone. I made this comment a lot publicly, and in fact, even the governor borrowed a line in one of his State of the State addresses 2 years ago, where something is wrong when we have multiple years of economic growth in California. And never mind this thing called COVID, we had economic growth in California despite COVID. It's a weird thing. Jack calls it a K-shaped economic sort of trajectory, where people that are at the low end of the economic spectrum are suffering in really unprecedented ways, but people at the top of the economic spectrum are benefiting enormously, and it's the top of that K-shaped curve that drives state revenues. State revenues have never been higher. So multiple years of economic growth consecutively, and despite that, hundreds of school districts are cutting their budgets. It just doesn't make sense. But if you pay attention to, and we've tried to explain to the legislature, when you don't focus on the base and you focus on one-time money and restricted money for all kinds of wonderful fun things, you're not paying attention to what fiscal solvency we need in school districts. That's the issue. And that last bullet, unaddressed cost drivers for the district, we're going to cover. So now what we're going to go into is, despite all of this good news about the amount of the budget, Jack's going to kind of walk you through the building blocks of what drives state revenue and puts us in a situation where Prop 98 has a benefit. So Jack, I'll turn it over to you. And feel free, you guys, at any time, if you want to stop us and ask a question, we're happy to take it.
Thanks, Kevin, for giving most of my speech here for the next couple of minutes. Mr. President, thank you for the invitation to be here, members of the board, and to the superintendent. I was on a school board in Santa Barbara. I also served in the legislature 20 years, and then as the elected state superintendent of public instruction. Only time I was ever afraid to go to our local grocery store is when I served on the school board. I know it's a tough job, so really appreciate sincerely and value this. We have put together a few talking points to go into, right, this one. Right here. On the fiscal conditions, kind of give you the 30,000-foot view of the economic situation here in California, how it obviously directly impacts the education budget and obviously trickles down to many of the issues that you are confronted with here today. We do have, in the short term, again, good economic news. California receives about 95% of its general fund revenue from three sources. And in order, it's personal income tax, sales tax, bank and corporation tax, and all three are up. And that's a healthy sign. But I'm going to go through some potential warning signs for us as we look at this. We also have not seen, as Kevin talked about, with that K-type economic recovery, yes, some people are doing very well, but a lot of folks are still continuing to struggle. Unemployment in California is more than 2% higher than the country. In fact, the country is about 3.9% right now. State of California is 6.5%. Even though we've seen a trend of some of the jobs coming back to California, the governor just went out and touted last week, nearly 25% of all of the jobs created in the country were created here in California. But that said, primarily because of COVID, primarily because of the economy not treating everybody equitably, we continue to see some lag in some of our significant industries. California really depends on tourism. our hotel business, our restaurants, air travel, all have obviously been significantly impacted by COVID, and that's a major, major issue for us. While we're seeing good economic recovery in the big picture, thanks to the tech industry, thanks to the wealthiest folks in our states, we just wonder, is this sustainable? And you can talk to economists, and the answer is clearly no. So we have to really, really be careful. COVID remains the first, second, third biggest issues facing us as a state. Will there be a partial economic shutdown in some segments of the economy? Are we going to be able to continue to do the really heroic work with the schools to keep our students in class, on task, and continue to learn? And you walk through any town and you see signs that talk about labor shortage. We need to hire people, hiring right now. There's a school superintendent, a good friend was telling us the other day, the fast food restaurants across the street from his school district office all have signs up, $19, $20, $21 an hour at a time when he's trying to hire classified employees, around that same ballpark figure. So that's a real challenge for him as well. Inflation is real. I mean, Kevin referenced that. The president talked about a week ago over 7% for the country. And yet the COLA, which isn't new money for you, the COLA, as you know, is designed, I always like to say, to tread water, to keep your head afloat, right now is 5.33%. And yes, projected to go a little bit higher, but the COLA mechanism that we use as a state is not the best indicator for actual costs incurred that we have today. It may have been at one time. And then we have the ongoing supply chain dynamics as well. So what are some of the major threats to us? It's the high income earners in California. I have a chart that will show you this in a minute, but we get 45% of our personal income tax money from the top 1%. And if they're doing well in the stock market, then capital gains, helps us a great deal. But if the stock market, and look at the volatility of the stock market the last couple of weeks. I checked driving up here today, and the Dow is up to over 35,000 again, which is a good sign. But it's been fluctuating, and it's been so volatile, obviously well documented, that gives us concerns on our personal income tax side as well. And then we have to be concerned, with wildfires that we have, the drought, and other extreme considerations as well. The next one that we have here, the next slide, is it this one here? Okay, good. Just we wanted to put this slide together to show you state general fund. This is a state general fund that's predicated upon Proposition 98, how much money will be allocated to the K-14 school systems that we have. That green line that we have, that's the number that the Legislative Analyst Office is projecting. And the LAO is independent, nonpartisan, well-respected, works for the legislature. And they have higher revenue estimates than the governor does. The governor's number is the one in the middle. And I would round off looking at about $190 billion. And LAO's looking at about an additional $10 billion. The main reason is the governor's projecting to try to provide some relief to businesses and corporations. So the corporate tax projections are a little bit lower for the governor, about $10 billion. But you look at the budget for 2 years, that could be $20 billion less than the LAO, and that's a significant impact for us in public education. And then that purple line is where the budget is for this year, about $175 billion. And then this last chart that I wanted to show you, I find this really to be quite interesting. If you just kind of focus on the screen I'm looking at here is the purple. That's the personal income tax. Two-thirds of all the state general fund revenue comes from hardworking Californians, the personal income tax that we have. And then if, stay focused on that for a second. Almost half of that comes from the top 1%. So if you see Mark Zuckerberg walking down the streets of Marysville, thank him, because it's him and his wealthy friends that are footing half of that increase. But that should also has to be a concern. If they're not doing well in the stock market, if they're not doing well with their businesses, if they move out of state, they're taking half of our personal income tax with us. And I'll take it one step further. 80% of all that money comes from the top 20% of the taxpayers in California. Sales tax is number two. Bank and corp would be number three. Has this changed over the years? Absolutely, yes. 40 years ago, the majority of the money State General Fund came from the sales tax. When we needed revenue in the legislature, when we had, I'm thinking of the Loma Prieta earthquake in the 80s, the Whittier earthquake shortly after that, what did we do to generate money to help rebuild those areas of the state? We raised the sales tax, not the personal income tax. Now, if you want to go after money, and you see this through some of the initiatives that people are putting forth, they're looking at the higher tax brackets there as well. We do better. When I see a pro baseball player or a basketball player signs in California, is going to live in California, and signs a $300 million contract for 10 years, I smile, because that means California has somebody that's helping us foot that bill. So with that, Kevin, I think I'll stop and tee it up. Yep, for Bear.
Great. Thanks, Jack. I'm going to cover what we're talking about in terms of what's on the table right now in the budget discussions at the state level across a number of programs. And this slide kind of is a tally or a table of contents of all of those items. And to go back to something that Kevin was talking about in terms of the mix of, one-time money or restricted dollars, this is really where you can see all of that here. Starting with 3.4, this is of the $16 billion, right? This is where it's getting spent. The biggest one here, and you can see they kind of go in descending order, starting with ongoing purposes. So $3.4 billion of ongoing money of the 16 goes to the expanded learning program. This is the program we created in last year's budget for before and after school programs and adding some summertime. Great public policy, right? We want kids to have more instructional time, more enrichment time. However, this is kind of pushing the accelerator, pedal to the metal a little bit, putting more in there. What we're finding, and I know this is true here, is that turning this program on during COVID has been nearly impossible in a lot of communities because you can't staff it at the level that's required by the law. And if you can't staff it at those levels, it's actually a condition of receipt of funds. So we have a lot of districts around the state taking a look at this and looking at their local market and saying, we just don't have the bodies. So they're really hesitant to implement the program. So a proposal, to augment that program by $3.4 billion, the single biggest ongoing funding increase in the entire proposal right now is for this. So this I'd put a pin in terms of what we are going to watch at the state level to see if they might shift. For example, you could still put $1 billion into this program and shift the 2.5 back over to the base grant, right? That would be really good. That's to Kevin's point, putting money back in the base operations of districts. So that's a big one to watch. It costs $3.3 billion to do the COLA, which we've talked about. And then there was some language in last year's budget that requires districts to do universal meals this year, right? So two meals for kids every day when they come in, and I'm sure you've been talking about this, but it was contingent upon an appropriation in the budget this year. So we're having that conversation, and depending on whether you have kitchen facilities and that kind of a thing makes it easier or harder. So I think a lot of the conversation is going to be around augmenting this a little bit to make sure that the appropriation is going to be sufficient to make sure that everyone can get the meals to the kids that need them. Again, and not an issue of whether the policy's right or wrong. It's just, are we funding it appropriately? These are all ongoing. And then an expansion for TK, they have to rebench Prop 98, which we won't get into here, but that's a good thing. So they're actually giving you new dollars for new kids instead of, taking money from other kids to pay for new kids. So that's a really good thing. Some increase here for special ed, so a $500 million increase statewide for special education, which will go into the rate, and that increases, so that's good. And then at that point, that's kind of you draw the line. Those are ongoing proposals that we're actively debating from the governor. Starting with that, fourth from the last bullet, $3.1 billion. These become, one time, right? And this is where a lot of this money gets, of the $16 billion, a big chunk of it is going to be one time for you and has some strings tied to it. So $3.1 billion is going into the Prop 98 reserve. This is a constitutional requirement that per Prop 2, this was Jerry Brown's Prop 2, you know, rainy day fund, part of that for us in K-14 is that there are pieces of Prop 98 that get siphoned off and put into a savings account. So that's $3.1 billion. $2 billion is going to pay for some college and career pathways dollars. So to Kevin's point earlier, in terms of making sure the district's going to be able to access these if they want, we're going to be following this. The trailer bill language, that's the actual bill language of how the program works, actually came out last night. So our team's been digging through that. Whether it's competitive and, you know, how much paperwork folks have got to do, like all of that stuff's going to be, we're going to be working on that. That's also one time. By the way, that is in addition to the CTIG dollars. So any of the existing career tech work you might be doing, this is in addition to that. So that will be good. The governor's got a bunch of proposals this year around green energy. And for us in schools, one of those is $1.5 billion for electric buses or doing conversions on buses. So that's in there. And then $1.3 billion, this is non-98 money, but it's to help do some facility stuff. The legislature and the governor over the next year, I suspect, are going to redesign the school facilities program and how we construct schools and modernize schools. We're actually going to do this pre-COVID. There were some bills in the legislature. And then when COVID hit, all the oxygen got sucked out of the room. And so that got paused. But there's some what they're calling bridge funding here. So the folks that are in line for their matching funds at the state can get their projects going. But this is just kind of a big picture of where the major pieces of the budget negotiations are going on in Sacramento right now. In addition to that, there are policy proposals around how we fund schools. And there's a proposal from the governor, and there are, you know, four or five bills in the legislature that also touch on this issue. So I want to make sure you're aware of it, because it's going to matter in terms of how you're projecting ADA into the future and whether we're going to do enrollment. So with COVID, obviously, you know, we're a state that funds schools based on attendance. No mystery that when you have a global pandemic and kids can't come to school, you're going to have an attendance problem. And so the administration, the governor acknowledged that yes, attendance is down everywhere. Everybody's feeling this. We need to do something about it. They continue, however, to want independent study to be that place where kids go when they're on quarantine or, you know, they go. So, you know, that has its own challenges to it that we've been, for parents and for administrators and teachers, like, it's not great, but it's what they want to do. The issue is, as we think about funding each school agency going forward, what the current law says is that you're either going to get your current year attendance number for funding purposes, or your prior year, whichever's greater. Well, that only works for 1 year, and then you got a problem. So they're realizing this. And so their proposal is to modify that. This is known in law as declining enrollment protection for districts. They want to change that for everybody, except county offices and maybe charter schools. But they want to change it to say, look, you can get either your current year attendance number, your prior year attendance number, or the average of the last three attendance numbers that you've had. And in this case, because we did, with COVID, we did a 19-20 attendance was the same for 2021. So you just repeat those numbers. And then you would take your 21-22 number, and that would be, and you average those out, and that would be it. So this is the proposal from the governor. It's before the legislature. So this is changing the way we essentially stair step down. It still will have a decline, you know, think about it statewide. There's a statewide decline in attendance or enrollment. That's still going to show up here, but it smooths it out a little bit over a number of years instead of just having it be sharp drops. So that's essentially the conversation we're having with this proposal. In addition to that, there's a bill, Senate Bill 830, thank you, SB 830 by Senator Portantino. This is a bill that talks about somewhat of a different issue, but related, is switching to an enrollment-based funding model, or it's not quite enrollment, but it's pretty close to an enrollment-based funding model, which most other states use, by the way. The idea is that with attendance and you've got a pandemic and you get, you know, kids have got to go home, you're just going to see these weird drops. And maybe a better funding model is, you know, when you lose one kid, you don't lay off a teacher, right? The costs don't track necessarily with attendance drops. So the idea is to switch to a more enrollment-based funding model that might track better with that. That's contained in the Portantino bill. So the Portantino bill, this bill, and then a couple of others will kind of serve as a conversation for us at the state level around how we're going to deal with this stuff going forward. For budgeting purposes, you should probably use the governor's proposal here. That's what everyone, county offices are going to accept that, and the three-year average. So you know, Jennifer and folks in Falcon run you through what those look like, and you'll pick the number that's best for you in that scenario. Any questions on either the programs that are there or the declining enrollment, ADA and enrollment?
Any questions?
No. So the yeah.
Yes, so what I'm seeing in our neighborhoods is houses being built, but you're saying that we're having, so can you expound on that, please?
So it'll be, yeah, so then in some communities, there's growth occurring. And so, you know, your projections into the future could show, you know, a future uptick in enrollment, for example. Enrollment and attendance are doing this, they're usually pretty correlated, right? You know, districts, you know, between 88 and 92% attendance on any given year of their enrollment, is sort of par for the course. So your enrollment might track, and then your ADA would probably go up in a normal year. What I think the legislature is waking up to and everyone else is that when you've got dynamics like we have with COVID, that attendance doesn't track anymore with your general trends and population, that it's these drops that, and they're not correlated with a drop in costs. And in fact, in some cases, when you're scrambling to try and provide ed services to kids during a pandemic, your costs are actually going up when your funding is going down, right? So it's this perverse, weird incentive.
So when you said declining enrollment, are you looking at Marysville specifically, or are you looking at statewide?
Sorry, it's both, but it's statewide we're seeing a drop in enrollment generally. And then, you know, and you, Jennifer, you probably can speak to the local dynamic better than I can.
Locally, we don't have a declining enrollment. We have a lot of growth going on, so we're seeing, the ADA is declining, but our enrollment is
yes.
Yeah.
And actually, one thing I'll share, actually, Yvonne and I were on a call yesterday with our colleagues from the statewide associations. One of the things that they're looking at to do this is to take, you take your current enrollment number, which for you guys will be growing, which is great, and then apply your 1920 attendance rate to that. So that would actually be really good for you, because you kind of get the best of both worlds. You're gonna get the higher attendance number rate plus the higher enrollment. So that would actually be, that's just an idea that's being bantered around with the education advocates, labor and management groups. So just to share that, but we'll keep you posted on it. Did that help answer your question? Okay. Cool. Okay, and then Yvonne in our shop is here, and he is actually one of the state's experts on these two programs, STIRS and PERS. So I'm going to pass it off to him.
Hi, good afternoon. Pleasure to be with you. So I know this issue around CalPERS and CalSTIRS and employer contribution rates has been really front and center for school districts for a number of years. We've seen significant declines because the funding of these systems was changed dramatically back in 2014. And so you all, I'm sure, are very familiar with the fact that the governor and the legislature provided a buy down, provided multi-billion dollar investment to buy down the employer contribution rates for both CalPERS and CalSTIRS on behalf of school employers. And so what you see here is what that buy down represented in terms of a percentage decrease. For CalSTIRS, it was the 2.18% in this current fiscal year, and then for CalPERS, it was 2.16%. But the rate relief expires at the end of this fiscal year. So it's something to be really conscious of as you're budgeting for next year, is that there's a potential significant increase in employer contribution rates if nothing were to be done. And so the governor, in his budget proposal, did not include any additional rate relief, even though education stakeholders have really been beating this drum loud and clear leading up to this. So all that to say, if nothing were to change, you're going to see these increases that we have here. CalSTIRS is estimating that it'll go up to 19.1%, and then for CalPERS to 25.4%. What that means statewide, it's been estimated that that represents about $1.5 billion increase that school employers, that school districts and county offices will be contributing to both systems on behalf of their employees. So your school district would have to shoulder your portion of that, and it's something to be really conscious of. And as that compares to the COLA numbers that were being referenced earlier, that has the potential of eating up about half of the COLA that your district would be receiving. So a significant blow in terms of just next year and future out years as well in terms of your budgeting. So it's something that we continue to advocate on, certainly to know that you are talking about it as well, and the need to talk about it is really important. This is an issue that labor and management are aligned on, and so the Education Coalition is prioritizing this, as well as, again, districts and a number of associations as well, to make sure that hopefully we can buy down these rates, not only in the immediate year to come, but the ongoing liabilities as well, so there's a reduction as well in the ongoing rates. So wanted to make sure you're aware of that as you're planning for next year. And this will not play out until the budget's adopted, so that's something to be conscious of as well, that these rates, again, the updated rates in terms to reflect any investment that's made, we won't know until June. Late June when the budget's adopted and CalPERS and CalSTRS update their figures based on whatever investment is made.
Can you explain why, with this kind of a surplus, the governor is not paying attention to this? Why, I mean, this is a gigantic challenge for any district, much less us. When as you've already presented, the inflation, the COLA that they're giving us is almost worthless for what we're trying to cope with. So is there anything that we should be doing to bring this with everybody else to their attention?
Yeah, I think certainly part of the misunderstanding is the total amount of Prop 98 dollars that schools are receiving. And the belief that is ongoing money, there's this really misunderstanding by policymakers that so much of this is one time, whereas these are ongoing costs. And so there's certainly a need to talk about it, that these one-time investments that are being made, these categoricals that are in specific funding pots that are being put forth as well, that does nothing to help you in terms of the ongoing CalPERS and CalSTRS costs that you're having to grapple with. So certainly making that connection. But yeah, it's I also think just in this current year, I mean, it's all politics, it's all negotiation. So the governor, I think, and personally I believe that he wants the legislature to expend some political capital on this issue versus him putting it forth right now. But also identifying the funding source as well. Because we've been talking about a lot of clear, this can't come from Prop 98 funding. This can't come from money that you would have received otherwise. This needs to come from outside 98, especially given the point that you just made, that there's such a significant surplus that the state has available.
So it would be nice if they take it back to... Got a green light, Russell. Okay. It's awful nice that, you know, it has been reduced, but do you by chance, I know it's not on your slide, but by chance have maybe the 19-20 percentage rates? Because even though it's went down 2.18%, in the last 4 or 5 years, we've been seeing a 4 or 5% growth. So 16.92 is still significantly higher than it was 4 years ago. Is that an accurate statement?
No, that is accurate. Prior to the funding plans being changed in 14, they were about 8% on both sides.
So 2014 was about 8?
Yeah, and yeah, 2014 was right about 8%. And so it's more than doubled on the CalSTR side and nearly tripled on the CalPERS side since then. 2000, the specific year you identified, the 1920, wasn't dramatically different than that 16.92, because there was also some rate relief that was provided by the legislature that impacted that year as well.
So I do think the 2014 number is very significant, and that, I guess that's kind of what I was looking for, is when did it take the giant jump?
Yeah, from that point forward, it increased significantly year over year.
And then I think you had mentioned, and Randy alluded to, so just these costs right here are taking about half of what our COLA is.
Exactly.
That the district's receiving.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
I have a clarifying question.
And that's if the governor, I mean, that's if nothing is done, if to further buy down the rates, yes.
So quick clarifying question, you know, just, I mean, we are looking at the cost of living, the COLA increase and the impact of it on people's pockets as well. What's a conversation in the legislature about that? How are we providing relief to our employees for the rising cost of living expenses? I mean, and what happens to these costs? Is there something you can add to that conversation that I don't think we are having very publicly anywhere right now? But that's a big concern for us at the table. The cost of living expenses going up, and then the money is not really going up appropriately or proportionately.
Yeah.
It's the explanation earlier, which is investments in the base beyond COLA.
Yeah. You're speaking, Superintendent, to the very issue I raised a second ago, which is if you don't pay attention to the base beyond COLA, you're not helping the people you say you support. You know, again, a lot of talk in Sacramento about caring about the employees that work for us, but we've got to have those augmentations if we're going to be able to pay. And one of the things we do, it's kind of a self-inflicted wound sometimes, because we talk about textbooks and we talk about program and we talk about just sort of education and some of the things we like to do in early ed and meals and all that. We don't talk enough about our employees at the Capitol. So then what happens is they do what they do, they pass all the money. You guys look at what they give you and there's not money for that. And then it ends up being your problem. People actually think it's your choice. When in fact, we have to work shoulder to shoulder with the entire Ed Coalition in Sacramento to make sure that we're underscoring that funding the base beyond COLA is the only way we get to a place where we can actually have a stable budget and deal with the very issues you just said. And, you know, when you take a look at this CalSTRS and CalPERS issue, it's such a great example. You know that when the governor helped us a couple of years ago, and Jack and I were really outspoken when the governor started taking action relative to COVID and we knew we had to go to distance learning at the very outset of the pandemic, we could see that the STRS-PERS piece, regardless of what the legislature did on the budget, was going to continue to go up, even if it suddenly we might be faced with cuts, which remember the governor was contemplating. We called for a freeze in any district costs to these two systems until and unless our budgets got stabilized. And what the governor appropriately said was, look it, I'm not gonna freeze it, we're gonna just pick up the tab for you. And we said, that's great. And to your point, Yvonne, they paid for it not out of the school budget. They paid for it out of the state's general fund. But what did they use to pay for it with? They used their one-time money on the non-school side of the budget, one-time money. So when they put in an item in the budget, like $1.5 billion for electric buses, and it's one-time money, we say we'd like to have $1.5 billion for school bus drivers. What do we need right now? We don't need electric buses, and God bless them for the electric buses, but it's $1.5 billion is a staggering amount of money. We just think that when you look at the overall budget, we're not trying to be ungrateful. We're trying to say it needs to be spent in wiser ways that give us stability and the ability to do new good things. There is a way to do both. But right now, the way the budget sits, we got some work to do. So with that question, we're going to have Barrett talk a little bit about the facilities picture, and then I'll try to tie some things up together.
And then, you know, not to get our wheels stuck in this, but you asked a question about what you can do, and I would say, I want to share something that, I can't remember if Vaughn was with me in this meeting, but we met with some legislators, and the chair of one of the budget subcommittees at the time, And he looked at us as we talked about this and he said, well, why did you negotiate those rates? This is the chair of the committee. That person thought that local boards and the community had negotiated these rates. And we had to remind them and educate them carefully without, hey, dummy. It was, these are set by boards in Sacramento. And in the case of CalSTRS, were actually set in statute by the legislature. They thought, or he thought, that this was something that you all did at the local level. And so to your point about what can you do, I would say as elected officials and making sure you talk to your representatives, talk to them about this issue, make it real for them. Obviously, share your numbers and your local circumstance, but then remind them of the fact that these are things that you have no control over. These rates are set by boards in Sacramento or by the legislature itself. So I think that's really important because the things you don't have control over in the world, this is one of the biggest ones and one of your biggest cost drivers right now. So anyway, I'll just share that. Okay. And then just, I wanted to cover some of the state facility dollars. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. The governor right now is proposing essentially to work with the legislature to rework the school facilities program, both for new construction and for modernization, but is proposing to use $1.3 billion in the budget year, so for 22-23, and then another almost $1 billion in the next year. To essentially serve as bridge funding until the legislature and the governor can work out the way this program works going forward. We're selling the last of the school bonds. The last school bond we had was Prop 51, passed in 2016. About $1.4 billion left there. And then we're out of state match. When we build schools, essentially it's a 50-50. Local communities put up half the money. The state puts up half the money. It's not quite that simple, but it's for this conversation. I don't think that part necessarily will change, but when you get in line and what characteristics of districts sort of open up pots of funding for you, I think is subject to change. There are a couple bills in the legislature related to this. I just wanted to put that out there. And then to the extent there's charter schools, they have their own separate pot and there's $30 million there for them. Okay, so Kevin, you wanted to kind of tie some stuff up? Yeah.
So I would just comment on the facility slide. So it's one of the other areas that was disappointing to us in the budget, is that we need another bond for modernization, new construction. That bond should be on the November 22 ballot. The governor did not come out and support overtly for that bond. We think he needs to. Now, he does make the case, look, we got billions of dollars. Let's do a pay-as-you-go. Let's use some of the money that we've got to do school facilities. That's all fine and good if you're investing at a magnitude that addresses the need, not a Band-Aid approach. So the State Assembly has a proposal where they would like to spend $10 billion of some of the non-98 money, so it's general fund money, on school facility construction. If they could do that, that would be pretty meaningful. But if you look at what the governor does alone, and he doesn't endorse the assembly measure, and he doesn't endorse a school bond in November, we would have liked to see him endorse one of those two things or acknowledge we actually really need more. He calls it a bridge, so it leaves the question open. What's it a bridge to? But we really need to be more overt, because if you check the calendar, November's coming fast. And we know that in order to pass a school bond measure, which failed the last time we went before the voters, it actually needs a concerted, organized effort, not a last minute, ill thought kind of thing. So we got to work on that. So the way I wanted to kind of sum this up is to say, we've painted a picture of some of the shortcomings of the budget in terms of what we would want to see that would benefit this district better in the budget if they did some changes. I want you to know I am extremely optimistic that on several areas with the right advocacy, we're actually going to be successful. But there's this old adage, which is that, and frankly, it's practice, which is that we're obligated as districts to budget on what we know. We've got to adopt responsible budgets predicated on what is, not on what we hope it will be. But it puts an imperative on the advocacy work we do together to lobby to make sure people understand things. And so, for example, I had almost an hour conversation with Patrick O'Donnell the other day, the chairman of the Assembly Budget Committee, and he understands two issues really well. And he hasn't always been with us on the base funding issue, but he really gets it this time. He's in his last year because he announced, even despite he's not term limited, but he's decided to leave the legislature. So he's in his last year. He's really committed to focus on the base. But the other issue that he gets and other members get, and we've heard it over and over, is that STRS-PERS issue. So if we get a combination of things, the STRS-PERS issue, we get them focused on base funding beyond COLA. We get them to focus on some of these other issues, we'll be in good shape. And Jack reminded me to talk about a couple of other things too. We need to make sure that we're lobbying on whatever the COLA is. It needs to be across the board to all programs. You guys know that in the last few budgets, they do a COLA on the local control funding formula, but they don't give us the COLA on a lot of the categorical programs. And what we try to tell them is all those employees are the same employees they work right next to. And when we negotiate agreements, when they do that to us, we actually have to take the COLA and lower it, because if you don't give it to everybody, we have to lower it and then spread it so everybody gets the even amount. So you might think as advertised 5.33 or 6.1 or whatever it ends up being, but if you don't spread it across all programs, it actually ends up being a lower number. We don't want that to happen. We want to make sure they're doing it across all programs. The other two things that Jack reminded me about was what's going on in Washington, D.C., which is cause for potential optimism. The president put into his budget proposal that would normally be adopted by October. He put in his budget proposal two very big things. One is that we get to full funding of special ed to match the Fed's promise within a 10-year period. Each year that you would do that, and he put a big amount of money in the first year, you would get more money than they've ever put as an increase in special ed in the last decade. So even though it sounds like a long time, 10 years, each of those years would be huge contributions that ultimately trickle down to us. So getting to full funding on special ed was one part of his budget. The other part of his budget was with regard to a tripling of Title I funding. That impacts this district. And so what happened to the president's budget is because he was trying to get his Build Back Better plan, his infrastructure plan, a number of other priorities, he wasn't able to get the budget passed on a bipartisan basis, getting a few Republicans. And as you know, when he doesn't get a budget passed, they do what's called a continuing resolution, which only gives you whatever you got in the prior year. Well, Democrats and Republicans are working right now. There was news on it today. They think they're actually going to give him some increases in key areas because they would like to see some increases on the Republican side in defense spending. So a deal is in the works to get some increases. We know that the issue of early education and special education, not necessarily Title I, but those other two issues, attract Republican votes. So we may see some news on that front. We hope we do. The president's new budget for next year gets introduced in March. So he'll probably bring all of those proposals back. He's probably going to continue to work on it. We have to lobby for that. So now you sort of have the picture. We've got an agenda on the federal side that needs attention. I know that CSB and ACSA are doing a major push on federal issues in April. That'd be great if you guys were going to participate in that. And I'm going to be going back to DC and working with them on that stuff. And then we've got the state push on all the issues I just outlined. And there are key sort of talking points. And the last thing I'd leave you with is one of the things that we would suggest you guys consider is a legislative platform for the district. It would then outline all of these key areas that affect just you guys. And then when we adopt it, we can send that to your state legislators and say, this is what we're for, this is what we need in this district. And it's a board-approved document that you guys have input to and would be kind of a next step for us. So that concludes our presentation, Madam Superintendent and members of the board. We really appreciate the opportunity to be before you today.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Absolutely. I do have one thought. When you talked about maybe trying to sway the governor to the CalSTRS and CalPERS seemed like just a huge issue. Would it be beneficial, and I don't know if resolution is the right terminology, but if we try to develop, or maybe your company could develop a boilerplate resolution that we could agree on or adopt and send that to the governor saying we need a freeze on or whatever maybe it is. Because again, I think if we could just get that 2.5% COLA back that we're looking at paying for that, then it would be much easier to move those funds on to our employees.
Happy to do that. It should, I think, be part of the platform. It should be in communications to the legislature from this district, and we're happy to enable that advocacy. And I think it's going to be very important that they hear from you. This is one of those issues I'm optimistic on, but if they don't hear from people, we're not putting the pressure on them. That doesn't help. We got to do our part.
So that is something your company could do?
Absolutely.
Try to develop that, and maybe we could get with the unions and together try to say, this is where a lot of our money is going, and we don't have anything to say about it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Mr. Gordon, would you take a few minutes to introduce yourself and Capital Advisors and the impact that you've had on education and on
school districts? We sort of jumped into this real quick. So Capital Advisors Group was started about 10 years ago by a lot of the guys that you see sitting here. And then we had Susan Stewart. I don't know if you guys remember Susan Stewart, a veteran lobbyist, been around the Capitol for a long time. And then we also have LeAngela Reed, who is like a, sort of the preeminent advocate who covers state board issues, you know, a lot of early ed issues, career technical education issues. She's part of the founding group as well. It's a firm that has 10 registered lobbyists, by far the biggest, most influential lobbying firm in Sacramento when it comes to education. There's a lot of lobbying firms, but there's not any our size that just focus primarily on education issues. And of course, having Jack O'Connell as a co-founder of the company and somebody that's doing work, the Rolodex he has, the influence that he has, I like to say there's nothing that's happened legislatively in the last, you know, few decades that don't have his fingerprints on it. And he always likes to say, only the good stuff. And but having him as sort of the center of our firm has been really, really terrific. And for us, again, it's about being counted on, not just being a communicator of your sentiment, but being in a room where we can actually help write language. We actually help shape the outcome of what they do is the objective of our firm. You know, a PR firm could do the other thing. A legislative advocate is actually involved with the legislation itself and helping to try to get you that information. The other thing that we do as a firm that's really important, you know, much to the chagrin sometimes of our statewide counterparts, is we tend to know about stuff that's going to happen before a lot of others do. And I think equipping the superintendent and then her being able to share with you as a board stuff that's about to happen just is always really helpful in the community so that you guys have a sense of what's going on so that when you get asked, you're able to answer questions intelligently about what we expect and the areas that we need to keep working on with our lawmakers. So, yeah, we're based in Sacramento. You know, again, our portfolio is all across K-12. We have experts on a number of different key areas, notable expert in the expertise in the area of budget and finance, assisting CBOs in your district level work, as well as the state work, translating that so that you guys are maximizing resources, but then also in the whole array of other issues. We happen to be the lobbyists for the California School Nutrition Association. We're the lobbyists for all the school counselors. We're the lobbyists for every major facet of what we do in K-12 education. If there's a group that speaks on behalf of those major pieces of the education puzzle, you know, we're the number one advocates on career tech education. Just look at the governor's budget and look at where he focused a lot of resources on major areas. We represent a lot of the groups that they care about, so we can help push the political buttons that they respond to. So that's a little bit about the firm. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to give that background.
Yeah,
yes, and Yvonne Carrillo, who did present
your,
to you.
The folks that are here.
Pardon me?
Could you give us the names of the people that are here?
Yes, so Yvonne Carrillo, who spoke on the STIRS-PERS issue, is the newest of the team who came from AXA. We stole him fair and square. He was a senior lobbyist there and joins us with a good deal of experience in the legislature and over at AXA. And then, of course, Barrett Snyder, who's not just a co-founder of the company and a full partner of the firm, but Barrett actually runs the entire lobbying function of the firm. So even though, you know, I'm a registered lobbyist, I have my own little title in the firm, this guy's my boss when it comes to the things that I'm directed to help lobby on. And so that's Barrett's work. And then, of course, Jack O'Connell, the former state superintendent, and myself, Kevin Gordon. He's our driver.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all so much again. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Just one other thought would be, if the presentation that you gave today, if that could be given to the superintendent, maybe we could put it on our website, and then we could,
yes,
we could all access it, and maybe though all those names and your titles could go along with that.
Happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good point.
Are there any other questions from the board? Are there any questions from the audience?
Good afternoon, Mr. Davis. Probably not a surprise that as the president of the teachers union, might have a couple of questions, possibly either for capital advisors or for the board. One question I do have that I do know is for the board is I'm just curious when the board is going to allow the labor groups and the unions equal opportunity to present our view of the elephant as far as the state budget and the district's budget even. We have 2 hours for the district now to do it because we do know from the last board meeting that Capital Advisors is now on payroll for the district. So I'm just wondering if you can tell me when the labor groups may be allowed the same.
Dr. Fall?
I think that's a conversation we can have with Jennifer Passalia and with Rocco and set that up as a presentation at negotiations and bring it back to us.
And
because this is an information item only, so if this is information that you want to provide, fine. Otherwise, negotiations should happen off the table here.
I'm not negotiating. I'm just asking for equal time and equal opportunity is all.
We can definitely talk.
And then as far as a question that may be able to be answered here, I'm curious why, if anybody can tell me why we may be having a lot of talk about declining enrollment when we're not in declining enrollment, because it kind of seemed like that was being put out there. And I have to tell you, on our end, it seems very much like sky's falling, doom and gloom. We'll also throw in declining enrollment along with it, so it sounds really bad, and we're not in declining enrollment.
Happy to respond.
Please add.
No, the one, and it mirrors some of the confusion that's actually going on in Sacramento. You have two sort of things happening at the same time. One of the issues that we have is a drop in attendance, daily attendance. That we want to mitigate, but clearly in the district we don't have declining overall enrollment. And in fact, there's going to be an opportunity in the legislature, as I think Barrett referenced, with legislation that might actually present the opportunity for us to get augmented funding based on enrollment, not just ADA. If we ended up passing legislation like that, it would take a look at what your ADA is, then it would do a calculation for what if we funded you on enrollment and actually give you the difference. There's some problems with that bill that I think we and labor are going to see eye to eye on, where they lock up 50% of that money, can only be used then on truancy and attendance related purposes permanently, even if you don't have a problem. We'd like to see that enrollment-based funding provided, and then to the degree that you have a negative variance in actual attendance or truancy that you need to address, you deal with it. But once you solve it, it then gets unlocked and is discretionary money. But 50% is way too much. It undermines the whole benefit of having that. So you guys have the enviable position of being not a declining enrollment district, but you do have short-term issues, challenges with regard to attendance. And we want to make sure the legislature mitigates that financially by setting up rules that don't penalize districts. But it's a really good question, and it deserves some clarity.
And I can answer to that. We had Brian run 5 years of enrollment data, and it does show it's not declining because we have such, you know, developments happening. But as we presented to the board just last week about the inter-district permits, and that you've seen the impact of many of our students leaving us because of facilities not being able to accommodate our children, like in Edgewater we're losing. And we presented that last time specifically for the community to understand that it isn't a declining enrollment, but the enrollment numbers have fallen because so many of our children have left our district. And that's a major issue. And so thank you, Angela, for clarifying that question. But I'll share with you the 5-year data.
Thank you. Also, it was mentioned during the discussion of the ELOP, and Capital Advisors accurately described the fact that we can't staff at those levels. And I'm just wondering if either the board, the district, or Capital Advisors thinks they might have any explanation as to how it is that we can't staff at those levels? Because on the union front, we have a couple of answers to that, but I'd just be curious what Capital Advisors, the school board, or the district may think as far as why we can't staff at those levels.
Yeah, I'm happy to respond to you. Yeah, so what we're trying to paint a picture to the legislature, and again, I think we've had the support of our partners in labor on this, to say that when the legislature puts a bunch of rules into that program, like, for example, the student to adult ratio that we have to have, combined with the idea that you have to now create immediately a 9-hour program across all elementary grades, including TK, 9 hours, and 30 extra days a year. What we're hearing, and we've had conversations with our labor partners in Sacramento about the very real palpable fatigue amongst our teachers and our classified employees right now, and their own concern about our ability to recruit and retain people to fill those. There are districts and places where they're ready to go. There's a major district down in Southern California that said, we're able to do it, and the way they're doing it is they're making the offer to parents, and they're fortunate that the number of parents that want to opt in is a slow enough gradual increase that they can shoulder the obligation as it grows. Our problem is going to be in districts where everybody says, I'm in. And you have to build, you have to go from zero to this huge capacity overnight, and you don't have it. If in working in partnership with your labor group, I mean, it's going to be the first place to go, right? And I trust that you guys would do that, which is we go to labor partners to assess what is our situation. And frankly, that'll be good information for us to have so that when we're in the room talking to legislators about what do we need from them on the way the rules are going to operate, that if we say, well, we actually have a district that has capacity to respond to that today, they're going to want to hear that. And so we welcome that assessment in the information that ultimately we'll provide at the Capitol.
You mentioned the 50% unduplicated challenge.
Yes, that's a major challenge. Thanks for reminding me, Jack. So one of the rules in that program is that, yes, you offer it to all your students across those K-6 grades, but that you must provide it. Not optional. You must provide it to at least 50% of your unduplicated count kids. So you take a look at those kids that generate concentration grant money and supplemental grant and concentration grant money. And if you don't get to that 50% threshold in actually serving them, you lose 100% of the money. So imagine you're a district that does the right thing and you try to implement it and you don't get to that mark. You've incurred all the expense that ramped up to whatever you were able to do, and the state pulls the rug out from under you. These are some of the rules that got to change. They've got to look at the practical ability for us to implement. So when we talk about staffing challenges, that's part of it. So, thanks.
On the labor end of it, since we're talking information, I will also tell you on the teacher's end of it, part of what you're talking about, the fatigue. But right now, we also have an issue in teachers not feeling like their time and their work is valued and therefore compensated. And that's regardless of whether you're talking about our ongoing salary, whether you're talking about our extra duty and our hourly rate. And so right now, you are working your teachers and running your teachers specifically into the ground. I could also venture a guess as far as other groups, but I don't know that for sure. So on that front, and that you're talking about ELOP funds, which can obviously be used for that. So the board needs to be aware of the fact that you're running yourselves into a problem there as well. Part of your staffing shortage is going to come from the fact that people don't want to do the increased work. One, because they're absolutely dying on the vine from their real full-time jobs. And two, because the district doesn't want to compensate people for it. Additionally, when we got down into talking about enrollment and then talking about the reserve, just as a point of information as well, and I'm not sure, I assume Capital Advisors also has this because I do know, highly respected group, been doing this long enough, I at least know the name and recognize you guys, so thanks. But when you're talking about our enrollment actually going up, and we've got $63 million in the bank, and we're talking about not being able to fund COLA here, I think the district should be aware of that piece of information as well, that yes, even if the state doesn't come in and swoop in, be the miracle workers that they are and say that they're gonna buy down the COLA or buy down STRS, that still doesn't preclude the district from being able to offer COLA with $63 million in the bank. You're looking at, you'd have 60 years that you could spend a million. And so just putting some of those dollars and cents out there as well, because we're talking a lot of doom and gloom, when actually, I believe there was a statement about at the state budget level spent in wiser ways. That could be true here as well, because I don't know how we have all this doom and gloom when, and I don't mean just from capital advisors, I mean for years we've had the doom and gloom here as far as budget goes, but yet our reserves and our ending balance keeps going up year after year after year. And so it's kind of hard to try to convince your employees that you're so hard up and that it's impossible to pass COLA on to folks when they can see that with their own eyes. And so I know capital advisors just coming in, hopefully maybe they can help the board out with some of that information as well.
And I do want to respond to what Angela said, and I think she said the best thing, you know, she ended with really a point that is well made. I think with the kind of budget balance that we currently have and the restrictions to some of those budgets, we do need the advice of people like capital advisors to help Jennifer, myself, and Rocco as we get more involved and talk to our labor partners open and honestly, transparently about what we can use for what we can't use. And I think many districts are in the same position as we are. Our balance looks so healthy. And then as we start desegregating it, there's such restrictions to some of those monies. And I think that's what they're asking us for. So today was, I wouldn't say a doom and gloom, but I think the reality of what the government in Sacramento does to school districts, where they give us this Santa Claus present, and when you open the present, it actually has locks on the boxes that you have to open the boxes, right? So I think we heard today very transparently, and I hope the board was able to understand the $16.1 billion unbelievable amount of money that has such restrictions. The next time we meet, and I would love to have you back, and that's what I think our labor partners would like, it's time to sit with Jennifer, myself, and we have our director sitting at the back, Cindy Helms, to just kind of unpack our budget and start talking about these are your restricted, and I think that's important, and I think that's what they've been asking for a long time. Thank you.
Well put. Are there any other comments from the audience? If not, meeting adjourned.